This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A cholera epidemic has killed over 14,000 Rwandan refugees. The refugees need clean water, latrines, medicine, and more doctors. My guest, Dr. John Sundin, is an American surgeon who recently returned from Rwanda. He worked at a Red Cross hospital in Kigali from mid-April through the end of June. For much of that time, this hospital was the only medical facility in the city, and Sundin was the city's only surgeon. While he was there, he used a satellite fax machine to send letters to friends at Yale, where he had worked the year before as an instructor. Some of those letters have just been published in Harper's Magazine. We spoke with him earlier today from Connecticut about his experiences treating the victims of civil war. But first, we talked about the cholera epidemic and what created it.
It's a problem with water and sanitation. In India, Bangladesh, and the Far East, it occurs regularly. It's endemically. People get it in a low frequency all the time. Epidemics occur when you get too many people in one place and the water gets contaminated, there are inadequate sewage facilities, and you essentially contaminate the water with cholera, the bacteria, and it spreads like wildfire.
Why does it kill so quickly?
Cholera affects the intestine. It doesn't affect the rest of the body. And it causes, the incubation period is about 3 to 6 days. And then you have a sudden onset of profuse watery diarrhea. It can be up to 10 liters a day of diarrhea. You end up getting dehydrated. You go into circulatory collapse, and you can die within 10 to 12 hours. This is why it strikes, still to this day, strikes terror in people's minds. This is the name, the word cholera, because back in the old days, British troops in India, the mortality was 70 to 80%, and that's why it's dreaded even to this day.
But probably if you have water and antibiotics, it's very easy to treat.
If it's treated, the mortality is only 1%. You need the patients need to be rehydrated and treated with antibiotics. So it's easily treatable, but it has to be nipped in the bud early on because it's very contagious. And as is evident in this refugee camp in Goma, it spreads like wildfire and people die very rapidly.
So if you have thousands and thousands of people with terrible diarrhea because they have cholera, that's just going to make the situation much worse because there's no sanitation facilities.
Right, and so the thrust now, the first thing is to establish clean water. And this is clean water for a million people. A person on the average needs 5 liters a day for sort of cooking and drinking. That's 5 million gallons of water a day. And Goma's at the base of a volcano. It's a volcanic rock. It's not as if you can go just dig some wells and dig latrines. It's a logistical nightmare there.
Dr. Sundin, you went to Rwanda at the end of April. What inspired you to go?
I had been in Sri Lanka for 4 months in the fall with Doctors Without Borders in the north, outside of Jaffna, where the Tamil Tigers and the Sinhalese have been in a civil conflict for the last 10 years. So I'd basically taken this year off to do overseas work. So I had that experience in Sri Lanka. And actually, I was in the beginning of April, I was in Hawaii interviewing for a regular job in a private practice, and I was in Honolulu looking at the television, and I saw Kigali shots that were coming out at that time, right after the plane crash was April 6th, and the carnage started, and the photos were coming out, and I called Paris and asked them if they needed some help, and I was on a plane second week in April and on my way to Kigali.
Would you describe the hospital that you worked out of in Kigali?
It was set up from scratch April 12th. A Red Cross convoy and in conjunction with Doctors Without Borders, drove in from Burundi with large trucks and a surgical team and nurses to set up this hospital in what was before a Catholic girls' school run by nuns.
And you were the only surgeon?
For most of the time, I was the only surgeon, and we were the only hospital operating in Kigali.
Now, that civil war was fought with machetes and clubs and spears. What kinds of injuries did you have to treat?
Early on, we were seeing quite a few machete wounds, and these are machete wounds to the head and the neck and the arms and legs. And then they did not spare the women and children. We had quite a few children that had been attacked and would present with these wounds.
Did you know how to treat wounds like that? Had you ever seen anything like it before?
I had seen bad wounds in Sri Lanka, but those mostly were mortars and bullets. Nobody that I know has seen machete wounds of this type, especially that to see a child come in with machete wounds to the head and the neck, or somebody to come in with their hand amputated by a machete, this is something you don't see much anywhere.
How much did you understand the conflict, and how much was that relevant to the work that you were doing?
We had to be aware of the conflict, the local politics, because when I first got there, there were two hospitals. The one hospital was more the military hospital and more the Hutu hospital. And we were receiving more of the Tutsi patients. But then the other hospital was mortared, shut down, and we were getting everybody. We were getting the Tutsis, the Hutus, the military, the Interahamwe, the militia. And we had to be sensitive to the local politics and talking with them and being cognizant of what was going on, because here we were 2 miles from the front of this war, right in between the combatants, and having these militia around too, who had no sense of order or discipline. And so it was being neutral in a situation like that. You have to know what's going on to survive.
In one of your letters, you described the day that members of the Hutu militia, who you say killed Tutsis for sport, showed up at the hospital with clubs and spikes. What did they want from you?
Well, the day before was a typical day that we had received too many wounded and we were overwhelmed. We had one operating room and we were able to do maybe 15 to 20 cases a day. And that's if we weren't getting mortared. And it was during that time that for 3 days the mortar fire was so heavy that we weren't able to do any operating, and we spent most of our time in the concrete shelter because it was just too dangerous to venture out. And at the same time, every day 50 to 100 people are arriving with these significant wounds, and I remember the man, he arrived, and he was one of the many that we were watching, trying to get to, didn't have the time, didn't have the safety, and he died before we had a chance to operate on him. And he was one of the many that didn't make it because of that. And it happens that he had some friends in the militia that came the next day looking for their friend, and they entered this Red Cross hospital with their machine guns, with their arms, with their machetes, threatening to murder us. And
to murder you because you'd let their friend die?
Yes, there were accusations that we favored the Tutsis over the Hutus and this and that, when in fact we didn't. We treated everybody the same. But it's hard to reason with sometimes these people, and which we didn't reason, we hid, and fortunately the UN came by, because they would come by to pick up some bandages every once in a while, and they left, but they said they would be back. So it was a very tense situation there. It was tense enough, but having to operate, thinking that somebody's going to come in and shoot you for something that you were trying to do your best at. So it was a tense time for us all.
Where did you hide?
Well, when they were in the hospital, we were all up in, we had our rooms in the dormitory, and we had been eating lunch at the time, and we were hiding in closets and, because we all had walkie-talkies, so we heard that they were in the hospital. Armed people were in the hospital, and they actually made some of the Red Cross workers go up and dig up his body, because we had our own graveyard in the compound. So they made us dig, not me, but somebody else went up there, and they saw that his body had no scar on it, that he hadn't been operated on. And then they said that he had a million Rwandese francs in his shoes, which, you know, I don't know whether he did or not. But then they wanted where was the money? They wanted the money. It wasn't so much concern for their friend. They were trying to extort us for money.
Uh huh. Now you had good reason to be afraid. There were about 150 people who were massacred at a hospital run by Doctors Without Borders in Rwanda.
And down in Butare, that's why we were all very aware of the fact that these guys had a history. They had a bad attitude, and we were sensibly fearful for our lives and the patients' lives.
My guest is Dr. John Sundin. From mid-April through the end of June, he was the surgeon at the Red Cross Hospital in Kigali. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Dr. John Sundin, spent 2.5 months as a Red Cross surgeon in Rwanda. You got sick for a while when you were working in Kigali. What did you have? Do you know?
I don't know, because we didn't have a laboratory there. We had no X-rays, no blood for transfusion most of the time. I had a fever. I had to assume that it was malaria, although malaria wasn't that common in Kigali because it's a high elevation, but it did occur. It could have been some other things, but you don't want to sit on malaria too long because you can die from it. So I ended up taking the treatment for malaria under the assumption that it was, and felt better in a couple of days. So whatever it was, I got better. And was able to go to work in a day or so.
There was a nurse there who was trying to convince you to operate on patients who were coming to the hospital, in spite of the fact that you had like 103 temperature, and you decided not to. It must be very hard to make a decision like that, unless I suppose probably you were just feeling physically incapable of doing a good job, anyways.
Well. Limits had to be set, and after that incident or that decision, because we met as a group and we discussed this as a team, that we had as a team to set limits, because we were getting too many patients to take care of. You have to understand, this was a 500-bed hospital with just stretchers, no beds. There was no place to transfer patients. There was no other team to call in. We had no blood. We couldn't do everything for everybody. So we had to. It was a triage, which in medicine you choose the patients that have the best chance of survival and work on them. And choices have to be made. And I was in a position as the surgeon to make those choices. And as I said to her, that I'll take the hit, I'll take the responsibility, but we can't do everything for everybody. And That was difficult for the whole team because it was personally, ethically, emotionally, professionally very difficult to have patients dying who you could easily save if you had enough time, or staff. But we couldn't. So we lost a lot and we saved a few. But that came up in discussion, and it was part of. I brought it up in discussion because it was something that I had to deal with. Also, here I am, 103 fever, and this man needs an operation, and I have to say no. Because I had to set those limits on my own resources and the team's resources, and that was difficult.
It must be hard because you're watching somebody die right now, thinking that in the long run, this is what you have to do to preserve your ability to take care of the people tomorrow and the next day.
Right, and that's a decision that a few cases we did at night. A few nights we operated until 3 or 4 in the morning, but then the next day there wasn't another team, and then the next morning 50 or 100 other people would arrive. So after after a couple of those nights, I set the limit that no, we do not operate at night. We're the only team. We have our own physical and psychological health to consider, and we weren't going to do anybody any good if we operated 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and collapsed and had to be shipped out. So. After a time, we did not operate at night, and limits were set, and that's how we coped with the situation.
As you have to set these really difficult limits, do you find that you have to harden yourself toward the people who you're seeing because you have to set those limits, because you have to reconcile to yourself to the fact that you're going to lose people?
That's the triage in a war situation, and journalists were coming through every other day because we were on the tour of Kigali. So the UN would bring by a photojournalist, the video, and the print journalist. And they would see, yes, we would have, there would be patients everywhere, wounded everywhere. And over in the corner, there'd be a 5 or 6 year old child who had received a bullet to the head with exposed brain and over in the corner receiving no care because that child has a mortality of 95%. So they would focus on the emotional component of this child and they would ask us about them. But we were busy trying to save the other ones that maybe had a traumatic amputation of the leg or a bullet to the belly or somebody that had the chance of being saved. So they would tend to read us maybe as being unemotional and hardened, but that's the professional detachment that we had to maintain of not focusing on who we couldn't save, but focusing on who we could save. And in that context, it's totally different than working in any hospital that's not in a war zone.
What kind of practice are you returning to?
Well, right now I'm unemployed, so I'm in between and looking for a type of surgical practice which would allow me some flexibility to do this every year or two. That's difficult to find, especially if you enter in on a private practice. It's hard to tell your partner that you're going to be out of town for 3 months. So I'm going to be looking for some sort of position that allows me some flexibility to do that.
Does working in a war situation change your impressions of American medicine? Does it make you see it any differently?
Well, as a lot of people ask me why I did this or why I do this, and one of the answers I've come up with, which rings true to me, is that in a lot of ways I'd rather work for the Red Cross or Doctors Without Borders for very little money overseas in a civil strife zone where I'm getting shot at, where the need is phenomenal and people are really appreciative, than to set up practice in this country with the pernicious regulatory system and the paranoia about litigation, and to be able to go overseas, it's unfortunate that doctors and nurses sometimes have to go overseas to practice the kind of medicine that they really love to do, as opposed to trying to do that in this country with all the frustrations.
So how are you doing now? I'm sure when you were actually in Kigali at the hospital that you just keep working and you maybe try not to think very much. And then you come home and you have a chance to really reflect on the experience. How's your health? How's your emotional state?
Well, it's been good to talk about it to the radio, and also was part of my therapy while I was there was to write about it, to get it out. And we all saw the stress doctor in Geneva, because they recognize now that expatriates or people that work in civil strife zones have psychological consequences of that stressful situation. So people have asked me whether I've been having any nightmares, and my sleep cycle is very messed up. And the fact is, I don't think I'm having any dreams yet. I'm not even any nightmares. So, and I don't think I will, because although never say never, I think I'm processing this in my own fashion, as we all have to process it, and it will take some time to work it out.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
All right. It was good talking with you, Terry.
Dr. John Sundin worked as a Red Cross surgeon in Kigali from mid-April to the end of June. His letters home are published in the August issue of Harper's Magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.